Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to get into one of those really foundational rules, something you see across basically all societies. You shall not steal.
Right. It's fundamental.
Yeah, and when you first think about it, maybe compared to, say, murder or adultery, theft might seem, well, there's maybe a diminishing directness of injury.
That's a good way to put it.
We kind of take property rights for granted, don't we? But have you ever really stopped to think why this command is so core?
It's a great question. And that idea, the diminishing directness, it actually sort of plays out in how these commands are often ordered in ancient lists.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, killing someone is, obviously the most direct, the ultimate harm. Adultery hits relationships hard right away, very painful. Stealing is definitely wrong, no question.
Absolutely.
But that immediate visceral impact wasn't always seen as quite hitting the same level as those others, at least not initially.
That's a really interesting distinction. So, our mission today really is to explore how this commandment, number 8, has been understood, how it's been applied, maybe even stretched a bit.
Right, from way back in ancient law codes.
All the way to some, frankly, surprising situations today. I think you're going to find some unexpected ideas here, some surprising historical stuff, and maybe even challenge how we think about theft in our own lives.
Sounds good. Maybe some aha moments along the way.
Hopefully. So maybe we should start back then. How did ancient societies even think about ownership? And how did that shape their laws about stealing?
Yeah, good place to start. Because we kind of assume property rights today, don't we?
Totally. It's mine. You can't take it. You don't want your, burly neighbor just grabbing your lawnmower.
Exactly. Society needs rules, right, to stop the powerful just taking from the less powerful.
Yeah.
And it's actually fascinating how much focus some ancient law codes put on theft.
More than others.
Well, yeah, like the Middle Assyrian laws, they were really focused on adultery. But the Code of Hammurabi, that one put a huge spotlight on theft.
Okay. And what did that look like? Was it just fines?
Oh, no. The penalties in Hammurabi's code were severe, really severe.
How severe?
If you stole from the temple or the court,
Yeah,
capital offense, death penalty.
Wow.
Even just receiving stolen goods could get you executed. And get this, if you broke into a house to steal, the penalty was death right there at the point you broke in, and you'd be buried there too.
Whoa. Okay, that is incredibly harsh. Buried at the point of entry. That's quite an image, a stark reminder of how seriously they took property.
Definitely.
Was Hammurabi typical, though, or is that kind of the extreme end of
It
things?
was probably the strictest we know of in terms of capital punishment for theft, yeah.
Yeah.
But it wasn't all death sentences, even in Hammurabi.
Oh.
For instance, if a robber wasn't caught, the local community, the territory where it happened, they actually had to compensate the victim.
Huh. So, like, collective responsibility.
Kind of, yeah. It's sort of community fine or restitution, so property rights were clearly a big deal.
Okay. But then when we shift over to the Old Testament, the picture looks, well, pretty different, doesn't it?
It really does. A striking contrast.
The commandment itself is so simple. Just those two Hebrew words, lo tignof, you shall not steal, but the penalties. Unlike Hammurabi, most theft in the Old Testament seems to be punished with, what, a fine restitution?
Primarily restitution, yeah. Paying back more than you took, often. And if you couldn't pay it back?
Then what? Jail.
Not exactly jail as we think of it. You'd be sold into temporary servitude, basically bonded labor to work off the debt you owed. It feels like a very different underlying philosophy.
Definitely. So does that mean no theft was a capital crime in the Old Testament?
Ah, well, there was one type of theft that carried the death penalty.
Okay, what was that?
Stealing a person. Kidnapping. Especially if the intent was likely to sell them into slavery. That was something the Old Testament took incredibly seriously. Depriving someone of their freedom, potentially their life, that was seen as a capital offense.
That distinction is so important, isn't it? Because it really reveals something fundamental about Old Testament law here.
What's that?
It's this idea, this profound principle that basically people trump possessions.
Exactly. People matter more than things. That's absolutely crucial.
So, unlike maybe Hammurabi, where stealing from the temple got you killed.
Right, or where the penalty might depend on who you stole from, like your social status versus the victims. The Bible doesn't really make those kinds of distinctions for property theft.
It consistently puts human life, human dignity above material goods. There wasn't like an open season on thieves.
Precisely. And this principle gets even clearer when you look at how the law treated, say, killing a thief caught in the act.
Right, there was a difference between catching them at night versus during the day.
Yes, if a homeowner caught a thief breaking in at night, and in the struggle, the thief was struck and died, the homeowner wasn't considered guilty of murder. No blood guilt, as they called it.
Why not?
Because in the dark, you couldn't know their intent. Were they just there to steal or to harm you or your family? You had a right to defend yourself.
Makes sense.
But if the sun had risen, if it was daylight, and you could clearly see it was a thief who could potentially be apprehended and made to pay restitution, and you killed them anyway, then you were guilty of murder. You had blood guilt.
Because you bypassed the proper process. You took vengeance instead of justice.
Exactly. You took a life when the law prescribed restitution. It shows, again, very clearly, people trump property in Israelite law.
That's definitely one of those aha moments. Like you said, life is just a more fundamental right than owning stuff.
It is.
It makes me think of, there was that case, I think it was Texas back in the 90s. A guy shot and killed two teenagers who were stealing hubcaps from his car.
Shedrick Babbles, yeah. Remember that.
And a court actually found he'd acted legally under Texas law to protect his property.
Which is fascinating, isn't it? Because if you connect that back to the biblical law we were just discussing, it's kind of ironic.
Oh, so.
Well, Texas, often considered part of the Bible Belt, right? But in that specific instance, the legal outcome seemed to directly contradict the biblical principle. According to Old Testament law, unless your life or family is directly threatened, killing a thief over property makes you the murderer.
Hmm. So, okay, what's the takeaway here? It's not saying theft is okay, obviously.
Not at all. The Bible definitely doesn't excuse theft. It has consequences.
But it's fundamentally saying people come first, possessions second.
Right. And there's another layer, too. Theft isn't just seen as wronging your neighbor, taking their hard-earned stuff.
Uh-huh.
It's also framed as an insult, in a way, to God himself.
Okay, can you unpack that a bit? How is stealing from my neighbor stealing from God?
Well, the Bible teaches that God is the ultimate owner of everything, right? Heaven and earth.
Like in Genesis, creator of heaven and earth probably means owner.
That's a strong interpretation, yeah. And the Psalms talk about God owning the cattle on a thousand hills, that kind of imagery.
Okay.
So if God owns it all, he has the right to determine how his resources, his goods, are distributed among people. And a thief, by just taking things, is essentially short-circuiting that divine process, ignoring God's ownership and authority.
Right, like bypassing the system God set up. Now, modern law makes distinctions, right? Like robbery, using force, versus burglary, using stealth. Does the Bible see those differently?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. It clearly views theft involving force or the threat of force, what we call robbery, as much more serious.
Again, because life trumps property, potential threat to life.
Exactly. And this connects to the idea of oppressors in the Old Testament.
Which we might think of as like big corporations exploiting workers.
That's definitely part of it, yes. But the term was broader. It included armed robbers, people using violence or threats, also blackmailers. And these wealthy malefactors who'd use their power to cheat people out of their rights or property.
So manipulating the system.
Yes. Things like cheating widows and orphans who were vulnerable, or employers deliberately withholding wages from their workers. Leviticus 19 is really explicit. Do not defraud or rob your neighbor. Do not hold back the wages of a hired worker overnight.
So even stiffing your employees on payday was seen as a violation of you shall not steal.
Absolutely. It's depriving them of what they rightfully earned.
Okay, so we've talked about the what and the who. Let's circle back to the core why. Why is stealing wrong? We know it hurts your neighbor, takes their property. But you mentioned another principle earlier, something deeper emphasized in the Old Testament.
Right. Beyond just harming your neighbor, stealing demonstrates a really fundamental lack of trust.
Lack of trust in God.
Exactly. A lack of trust in God's provision. If someone feels they need something, say food for their family, and they resort to stealing it. On a deeper level, the Bible suggests they're showing they don't actually trust God to provide for them through legitimate means.
Mm. Even though Proverbs says you maybe don't despise a thief who steals because he's starving.
Right, there's some compassion there, but it still implies that stealing wasn't the right way. It bypassed God's established methods. Psalm 62 warns against putting vain hope in robbery. Trust God, not stolen goods.
So the basic issue is that theft cuts across God's intended ways of creating and distributing wealth, distributing goods.
Precisely.
And what are those intended ways, according to the Old Testament? How are goods supposed to be distributed?
Primarily through, well, through that word some people don't like, work.
Ah, the nasty W word, right? Work.
Yeah. But work in the biblical view, isn't presented as just a curse. It's actually the primary way we partner with God to receive his blessings, his provision.
Even back in Eden, right? Genesis 2.15, God puts Adam in the garden to work it and keep it.
Even in paradise, there was purposeful activity, work. Now, after sin entered the picture, Genesis 3.1, work definitely got harder by the sweat of your brow.
But it wasn't eliminated.
No, there's still no excuse from work. The expectation is that we work to produce and receive our goods.
Proverbs hammers this home too, doesn't it? Talking about the sluggard whose cravings kill him because his hands refuse to work.
It does. And the New Testament picks up the same theme. Paul in 2 Thessalonians has that really blunt line, anyone unwilling to work should not eat.
Pretty direct.
And in Ephesians, he connects it directly back to stealing. Ephesians 4.28 says something like, those who steal must give up stealing, rather let them labor, doing good work with their own hands.
So as to have something to share with the needy, wow, that's like the polar opposite of stealing. Work not just for yourself, but so you can be generous.
Exactly. Work enables generosity. Theft prevents it. And Paul doesn't pull any punches in 1 Corinthians 6.0 either. He lists thieves, the greedy swindlers, and says flat out, none of these will inherit the kingdom of God. It makes it clear this kind of behavior just doesn't fit with God's kingdom principles.
Okay. So, bringing this forward, how does all this apply today? I mean, most people listening probably aren't planning a bank heist or pickpocketing.
Right. The overt stuff isn't the main temptation for most, but there are definitely more subtle forms of theft, things people might even try to justify.
Like what?
Well, you mentioned earlier that some people, even some church leaders, apparently, were arguing that stealing from big corporations like Walmart isn't really a sin because, you know, they're oppressors or they can afford it.
Yeah, I've heard that kind of rationalization.
But the problem there isn't just the impact on Walmart, whatever you think of them. It's what making a living by stealing does to you. It directly contradicts that biblical call to work and provide, honestly.
And it gets even subtler, right? What about digital stuff?
Oh, yeah. Computer crime, pirating software, music, movies.
Copying that program for your friends because you think the company charges way too much.
Exactly. It's so easy to rationalize, isn't it? They're huge, they won't miss it, or it doesn't really hurt anyone.
But who does it hurt? Sometimes it's the smaller players, right? The actual artists, the indie developers, the creators relying on ad revenue or sales.
Absolutely. We're masters of justification. You mentioned that old story about someone stealing, was it vinyl records from a Christian bookstore?
Yeah, claiming they were using them for the Lord's work.
It just shows how far we can twist things. But pirating digital content, fundamentally, it's the same principle as physical theft. It bypasses the established, legitimate ways goods and services are supposed to be exchanged.
What about time theft? Like at work?
Sleeping on the job. That's another big subtle one. Wasting company time. Basically taking pay without giving the agreed upon work in return.
It sounds kind of extreme maybe, but some studies, they suggest the average person wastes, what, like 3 hours out of an 8-hour workday?
Minimum, yeah. That adds up. It's essentially taking money without producing value. I saw one survey where like 2% of workers admitted they did barely any work but still collected a full paycheck.
And the downstream effect is, well, if companies aren't getting productivity for the money they pay out, prices eventually have to go up for everyone else, right? We all sort of suffer.
It contributes to inefficiency and higher costs.
Yeah.
And then there's maybe the most profound, maybe the most overlooked form of theft.
Which is?
Stealing from God.
Okay. How does one steal from God?
Malachi chapter 3 asks that exact question. God says, will a mortal rob God? And the people are like, how? How are we robbing you?
And the answer?
In tithes and offerings. God's perspective there is essentially, look, I've given you all this abundance, all these resources, and I, as the owner, have a right to tell you how some of it should be used to support my work and purposes.
Now, that's a concept, tithing, that makes a lot of people uncomfortable today. Lots of debates about whether it's still required, etc.
Sure, the specifics are debated. But let's think about the underlying principle for a second. Forget the word tithe. Imagine you let your cousin Matilda stay in your lake cottage for the summer.
Okay.
You just ask her to chip in a small amount each month, say $50, just to cover utilities, basic wear and tear. She agrees.
Seems reasonable.
But then, month after month, she doesn't pay. She always has an excuse, unexpected expenses, car trouble. But you see her going out, buying nice things, living pretty comfortably, actually.
Okay, I see where this is going.
What is Matilda, really, in that scenario?
Well, she's kind of stealing, isn't she? She's using my property without holding up her end of the very reasonable agreement.
Exactly. She's a thief. And her attitude, her rationalizations, they're maybe not that different from someone who enjoys all the blessings God provides life, health, resources, community, but then refuses to contribute back to support God's work in the world, maybe even gets resentful when reminded of biblical principles about giving.
So it's less about God needing the money or sending lightning bolts?
Right. It's more about recognizing that how we handle the resources God entrusts to us is actually a reflection, a barometer of our relationship with Him. Our attitude towards giving reflects our attitude towards the giver.
That makes sense. So as we wrap up this deep dive on You Shall Not Steal, it really seems like that core truth keeps coming back. People trump possessions. That feels like the central theme weaving through all of this, from ancient laws to modern life.
I agree. And ultimately, the reason stealing is presented as so fundamentally wrong isn't just because it harms your neighbor, though it certainly does that.
Right.
It's also because it signals that deep lack of trust in God's ability or willingness to provide. It's an attempt to bypass His established ways of distributing good things.
Which primarily involves honest work.
Exactly. And that ties right into the whole concept of stewardship, doesn't it?
How so?
Recognizing that God is the ultimate owner of everything. We don't actually own anything in the absolute sense. We're managers, entrusted with His resources.
So our role is to handle those resources faithfully, according to His principles, His priorities.
That's the idea. Which leads to a pretty provocative final thought for you, the listener, to maybe chew on.
Okay, let's hear it.
How might really truly embracing this principle that people always trump possessions and consciously choosing to trust in God's provision through established ethical means like work and fair exchange, how might that actually reshape your daily choices?
In obvious ways, like not shoplifting.
Sure, but also in the subtle ways. How might it change your interactions, how you view your time at work, how you approach financial contributions or generosity? What might change if that principle was truly front and center?